20th century, from the Second World War. All kinds of activists are under repression. I mean, it's every day that we're getting news that somebody else got to jail or there is a new criminal case. Everybody under pressure from the state. It's a feminist activist, LGBT activist, environmental activist, human rights activist. Putin regime is just mad about civil society. It wants the end of a civil society. So if you decide to criticize Putin and Russia, you will just immediately go to jail.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vladimir Slivyak, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense 2021 Right Livelihood Award winner. And we will link to your reports at democracynow.org. Latest news, Norman Lear has died at the age of 101. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Portland. Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO's end of year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join. Go to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Cut through the clouds and make it rain to help us meet our $75,000 goal by December 31st.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon cancels a lucrative foster care contract.
Flooding closes a number of Oregon roadways, and
in national news, the rate of suicide deaths from firearms rises markedly.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 6th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Oregon has already experienced a lot of rain, and more is coming. Since Monday, the Tillamook area has received 3 to 4 inches, with 1 to 1.5 inches seen in Portland. Highway 101 remains closed around Tillamook and has been placed under a flood warning. A landslide halted Amtrak trips between Portland and Seattle until tomorrow. Another landslide closed part of Southwest U.S. Veterans Hospital Road, blocking one of the routes into the Oregon Health and Sciences University campus. In Portland, the body of a man presumed to have drowned in Johnson Creek has been found. Another drowned body was recovered in a Washington County creek. Half an inch of rain is expected in Portland today, with nearly 2 inches of rain anticipated over the weekend.
The Oregon Department of Human Services is canceling its contract with child welfare nonprofit Dynamic Life. The Child Welfare Division of the department made the decision following significant public scrutiny surrounding the religious nonprofit. Dynamic Life signed a contract of over $7.75 million last year with a state to provide support services for some 40 kids. That factored out to a payment of $2,916 per day per foster child placed in their care. The children in question needed temporary lodging or were already in temporary lodging, such as a hotel or a short-term rental. State officials declined to say why they decided to cancel the lucrative contract, saying only it was, quote, convenient for the state to cancel the contract, end quote. Dynamic Life, Inc. allegedly placed children in unlicensed short-term rental homes. Attorneys and children's advocates raised questions about the care and children were receiving when placed into the organization. Oregon's child welfare system has long been plagued by these problems, including lawsuits and a heavy dose of criticism. Jake Sunderland, a spokesman for the State Department of Human Services, did reassure Oregonians that our children are safe. He said, quote, "We are regularly monitoring the safety and well-being of the clients that we are serving, end quote.
Elsewhere in the United States, thousands of children in foster care are available for adoption. State agencies are partnering with faith communities to aid in their placement. Nadia Romlagan has more in the story from Ohio.
More than 3,500 foster children are available for adoption in Ohio, and state agencies are connecting with local faith congregations to help recruit families and place kids in caring homes. The One Church, One Child program is based on the idea that if every congregation identifies one family who fosters or adopts one child, there'd be fewer children without permanent homes. Jennifer Coller with Mahoning County Children's Services says local churches often offer resources for adoption.
It's our job to find safe, stable supports and placements for these children. The faith-based community has been longstanding in support of those endeavors.
Caller adds the agency has contracted with a community advocate to implement a local version of the One Church, One Child program by nurturing relationships with church congregations. According to the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, the state continues to struggle with a placement crisis for children in its custody. Between the summers of 2021 and 2022, more than 500 children spent at least one night in county government offices because they had nowhere to go. Caller adds the need for foster care and permanent homes is great, and the holidays can be an especially stressful and lonely time for children.
Our agency has over 300 children in foster care, and there's over 51 children in our permanent custody, which means that those children's biological parents have had their parental rights terminated.
Kevin Milliken with Lucas County Children's Services says multiple factors continue to drive up the number of children who are unable to safely live with their biological parents.
Mental health issues, opioid epidemic, job losses, a sustained poor economy, and all of those things have combined. I don't think there's one root cause, a conglomeration of all those things that continue to be a problem, particularly in Lucas County.
People interested in adoption or fostering can find information online at fosterandadopt.jfs.ohio.gov. This is Nadia Romlagan for Ohio News Connection.
Famed television writer and producer Norman Lear died at his home in Los Angeles yesterday. He was 101. In the early 1970s, Lear demonstrated that it was possible to make situation comedies that were topical, thought-provoking, and funny, at a time when plain vanilla sitcoms were the staple of network television. His first show was All in the Family, which introduced the viewer to Archie Bunker, an unapologetic bigot, who was unnerved by the liberal shift in both the country and his family. The shows immediately shot to the top of the ratings and remained there for 5 years, providing that real-world concerns and controversies could be intelligently and humorously covered in half-hour time slot. Some of Lear's other shows included The Jeffersons, about the struggles of an upwardly mobile black family, Good Times, about a black family dealing with poverty and discrimination, and Maude, about an intelligent and outspoken feminist. Eight of these shows worked to break down stereotypes while showing the humanity in central characters. Lear's impact was not just felt in television. In 1981, Lear founded People for the American Way, a progressive advocacy group for democracy and justice, that he started to challenge what he saw as the moral majority's right-wing Christian agenda.
Former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is leaving Congress at the end of this year. The California Republican made his highly anticipated decision 2 months after being ousted as House Speaker. McCarthy's decision will narrow the Republicans' already thin majority in Congress. This majority had already shrunk further this week following the expulsion of New York Congressman George Santos. McCarthy had been in office for 17 years, much of it in leadership. He won the House Speaker's gavel in January after an unprecedented 15 rounds of consideration. Yet he was removed just 9 months later after pushing a stopgap spending bill supported by Democrats to stave off a government shutdown. The Republicans' House margin will depend on the special elections for the seats of Democratic Representative Brian Higgins of New York and Republican Representative Bill Johnson of Ohio, as well as the election in New York to replace Santos. Higgins and Johnson are both expected to leave in the first quarter of 2024. House Republicans could have a 2-3 seat majority, depending on the results and the representatives' actual times of departure. McCarthy said upon his decision to leave, quote, "No matter the odds or personal cost, we did the right thing. That may seem out of fashion in Washington these days, but delivering results for the American people is still celebrated across the country. I never could have imagined the journey when I first threw my hat into the ring. I go knowing I left it all on the field, as always, with a smile on my face. And looking back, I wouldn't have had it any other way," end quote. McCarthy's 269-day speakership was the shortest in more than 140 years.
Senator Tuberville stops blocking military promotions. A border bill divides the House, and college presidents address campus anti-Semitism. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It was pretty much a draw. I mean, they didn't get what they wanted, we didn't get what we wanted, and you know, just when you change the rules, it's hard to win.
Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville is releasing almost all of the military promotions he's had blocked for 10 months. The hold was a protest over the Pentagon's abortion policy, which remains unchanged. After the Republican made his announcement, the Senate swiftly confirmed 425 nominees. He continues to block the promotion of 11 four-star generals. While talking about the House Republican agenda, Speaker Mike Johnson said the White House has been stonewalling their impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden. He defended their investigation as the opposite of the sham impeachments Democrats brought against former President Donald Trump.
You're seeing a very deliberate investigation, uncovering and following the facts, following the truth where it leads. That's what the Constitution requires the House to do.
Johnson says a vote to continue the inquiry will be coming soon. The administration's $110 billion foreign aid package looks stalled in a sharply divided Senate, with recriminations from both sides. Republicans are demanding a House amendment to toughen border policy be included with the aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is against it being part of the funding package.
Many Republican members say they want to do Ukraine. If they themselves can't put a border amendment that would pass, then what the heck are we doing?
Schumer says more does need to be done to protect the border, but says Republicans should put forward a standalone bill, which could gain bipartisan support. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says they'll filibuster the entire package if it's not included.
I'm advocating, and I hope all of our members vote no on the motion to proceed to the shell, to make the point, hopefully for the final time, that we insist on meaningful changes to the border.
Immigrant rights groups oppose the House plan because it would in many cases ban asylum and create barriers for migrants seeking it. Constanza Segovia with Hartford Deportation Defense is calling on Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy to stand against it, arguing the right to asylum shouldn't be negotiable.
Hopefully, we think that we can get Senator Murphy to stand strong and not bargain these key policies.
College presidents testified before a congressional committee about the rise in anti-Semitism on campus since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Harvard President Claudine Gay says they have to walk a line, confronting hate while protecting free expression, even for hate speech.
But when that expression crosses into conduct that violates our policies around bullying, harassment, intimidation, threats...
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has wasted no time calling for a special election February 13th to replace disgraced former Representative George Santos. Nassau County's Democrat and Republican leaders vowed to implement a vigorous screening process for those who will run. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during the program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact with an in-depth report on Gaza solidarity. At 7, it's the global sale. Then at 8 p.m., drinking from puddles. How fitting. Tonight's weather is no surprise. Rain continues early with clouds and showers overnight. The low will be 47. Tomorrow's weather will also unsurprisingly have rain, with some thunderstorms expected. The high will be 48. Today in history, in 1993, Judge John M. Woolsey ruled the James Joyce novel Ulysses was not pornographic nor obscene, despite having coarse language and sexual content. This is a major decision, affirming free expression, and established the principles that a court applying obscenity standards should consider. The work as a whole, not just selected excerpts, the effect on an average rather than an overly sensitive reader, and contemporary community standards. Judge Woolsey failed, though, to give a definitive literary interpretation of the work. Speaking of obscenity, unfortunately not with, the quote of the day is from screenwriter and producer Norman Lear, featured in our last story. Lear said, quote, "My shows were not that controversial with the American people. They were controversial with the people who think for the American people."
The 2023 White House Tribal Nation Summit is upon us, and the National Council of American Indians just held a tribal leader planning session. With those stories and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland hosted a press call Tuesday in advance of the 2023 White House Tribal Nation Summit. According to the Biden administration, the summit is an opportunity to strengthen the nation-to-nation relationship with tribes. Haaland announced a $45 billion investment in Indian country.
These investments are transformative and are addressing issues that for too long have been ignored and which now are having direct and immediate impacts on people's lives. The announcements we make this week are part of the lasting impact we are building in Indigenous communities.
The National Congress of American Indians held a tribal leader planning session Tuesday. Attorney Robert Adawi Porter is a former president of the Seneca Nation and now represents tribal clients. He was at the NCAI tribal briefing. Porter says justice issues are among tribal priorities.
One of the things that was really coming out today is how do we target the problem in Indian country dealing with fentanyl addiction? And our leaders are working collectively to try to expand tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indian drug offenders. This is trying to fix a 50-year problem of the Supreme Court saying tribes don't have jurisdiction over non-Indians. And what we see now with fentanyl and opioids is just an unbelievable epidemic, in part made worse by the lack of jurisdiction.
The summit is taking place at the Interior Department Wednesday and Thursday. Fry Bread Face and Me. It's a new feature film out now on Netflix with an all-Native American cast. Clark Adamitis has more.
Fry Bread Face and Me is written and directed by Billy Luther, a Navajo, Hopi, and Laguna Pueblo man in his mid-40s. Luther also narrated parts of the film.
My grandmother always spoke to me as if I understood her. English was something she refused to learn. I'm sure she thought one day I'd answer her back in Navajo.
It's a coming-of-age story set in the year 1990. An adolescent Navajo boy growing up in San Diego spends a summer with his grandmother on the Navajo Nation.
We didn't have to try to get it right. We got it right because we lived this, and this was our world.
Director Billy Luther says the cast was all Navajo, save one member who is an Alaska Native. He also hired Navajo crew members.
I just wanted to cast people who understood this Navajo world. Most of these people had to speak Navajo, so I just don't see it being any other way. If I was working with a non-Native crew, I would have had to kind of tell them how to do it.
The film is semi-autobiographical. The protagonist is based largely on Luther's own life, growing up as a Native American child in Southern California. The film explores the different sides of his life and identity.
I just tell the story that is true to me growing up off the reservation, you know, as some would say, an urban Indian, and also being three tribes, Navajo, Hopi, and Laguna Pueblo. They're very different from each other. So my perspective, my outlook, and also just my way of life is unique. And I think that's true for majority of Native storytellers, filmmakers, writers. just diving into that truth is going to be authentic.
Billy Luther lives in Los Angeles, and he's part of a growing community of Native American filmmakers there. I'm Clark Adamitis.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Thousands of Gazans have been forced to flee the embattled southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis after an Israeli Defense Force airstrike. The strikes also hit the southern border town of Rafah, where Israel had urged Gazans to seek safety. Israeli efforts in southern Gaza have intensified as the military focuses on finding Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari stated that Mr. Sinwar's house was in the Khan Yunis region and went on to say, quote, "Our mission is to locate him together with more of Hamas's leadership and kill them," end quote. The past 2 days have seen some of the heaviest fighting of the war, and Israeli commanders have described house-to-house gun battles. But the strike on Rafah once again demonstrated the dilemma faced by Palestinians as they try to avoid getting caught in the crossfire between Israel and Hamas. The bombing of Gaza has already seen an unprecedented amount of civilians killed, with human rights experts telling the New York Times the rate outpaces even the deadliest moments of the U.S.-led attacks in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. On Sunday, Israel advised over 600,000 residents in an area of Khan Yunis to evacuate and specified Rafah or Al-Mawasi as potential safe areas. But Israeli strikes have since hit both Rafah and Al-Mawasi, with the strikes on Rafah coming soon after the UN had warned that shelters were overwhelmed and displaced people were being forced to sleep in the street. International aid agencies have resoundingly criticized Israel's manner of publicly informing Gazans of safe zones through a QR-based grid map, calling the exclusively online map, quote, unusable. According to the Gaza Ministry of Health, at least 1,200 Palestinians have been killed since the resumption of hostilities on December 1st.
A new guide is released today by the Department of Homeland Security. It's designed to help churches, synagogues, mosques, and other houses of worship to better protect themselves. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, is an arm of the department. It regularly works with faith communities across the country to help prevent and deal with targeted violence against their facilities and members. David Mussington is the head of the infrastructure security at the CISA. He says the purpose of the newly released 16-page document is to offer practical information, guidance in getting assistance from the CISA, and to be less, quote, jargon-filled. The document names, quote, physical security performance goals for faith-based communities, unquote. These goals include things like trimming hedges to prevent hiding places for attackers, or only giving out necessary information during live-streamed religious services. It also names federal government grants available to houses of worship to pay for security improvements. This is a highly stressful time for many communities of faith, and the document itself responds to long-standing concerns. Congress first established CISA in the fall of 2018 to streamline federal cybersecurity efforts in the wake of concerns over the extent of Russia's involvement in the 2016 election and the fear of further cyber attacks on the U.S. Since its inception, however, the agency has been criticized for its lack of defined strategic direction. Current and former employees have stated anonymously the CISA appears more focused on its public image than tackling the nation's most difficult cybersecurity problems.
The rate of suicide by gun in the United States has reached the highest level since tracking began in 1968. That's according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. About 27,000 of 50,000 suicides in the U.S. last year were committed with a firearm. Over half of the gun deaths in America are suicides. While suicide rates have increased across all racial and ethnic groups since 2019, the amount of change differed drastically. American Indian and Alaskan Native peoples saw the sharpest rise with a 66% increase. The rate of firearm suicides rose 42% among black people, 28% among Hispanic and Latino people. Caucasians experienced the smallest bump, 9%, but maintained the highest overall rate of gun suicides. Federal researchers involved in the analysis suggested the coronavirus pandemic might have exacerbated many of the known risk factors for suicide. These include social isolation, strained relationships, and drug and alcohol issues. Gun sales also rose significantly during the pandemic. Michael Onestis is the executive director of the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center. He said, quote, When there are more firearms, there are more firearm suicides, end quote.
Holiday travel is especially hard on those with chronic health issues. Experts are advising on how to make things easier in general and how to deal with problems that arise on the road. Mike Mohn has more on the story.
Holiday stress is a concern for most people, but when you mix in travel plans and chronic health issues, those worries might be elevated. A Minnesota expert says now is the time to ensure a safe and healthy trip this season. Whether you're flying to a warmer destination or driving a few hours to a relative's house, Dr. Mary Boylan with St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth says preparation is vital for those with a chronic health condition like heart disease or being at risk of stroke. To start, she recommends you check in with your doctor to find out if you're healthy enough to travel. If so, getting the logistics down should be the next priority.
It's really easy to think, oh, I'm just going to fly here or fly there and forget about the details. So if we can take those actual itinerary items off the table and have arranged to have a cart, if we need a cart to get us to our gate, that's a really good step.
Safely transporting medical devices is another priority. Boylan recommends checking with transportation agencies and companies about their policies for storing and screening them. Having enough medication is important, too. And if you're traveling to another time zone, experts suggest you talk with your doctor about adjusting your medication schedule. Boylan also is president of the American Heart Association's Midwest Region Board of Directors. She says when you get to your destination, having fun is the goal, but don't feel like you have to go beyond your comfort zone.
And we should really build in downtime. You know, it is a very, very good thing to, in the middle of the day or before the end of the evening, just settle down and have a little time for peace.
She says that can help to keep blood pressure in check amidst all the travel and activities you're trying to squeeze in. Other tips include locating nearby health facilities during your trip and, for long flights, wearing compression socks to prevent blood clots. This is Mike Mohn for Minnesota News Connection.
It is Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who wishes he could bathe in an atmospheric river.
Wishing the atmospheric rivers would wash us clean, but those needing the most redemption are in high-rises and on ridgetops, with all their backwash and flood mud coming to us in the flats. The media warns us of too much rain or too much snow, but nothing about too many billionaires, making the world worse with their hordes of inactive money and their habits of consuming and polluting a thousandfold. Enough rain to cleanse the blood from Israel and Palestine would inundate the landscape worse than in Noah's time. While the Gazans have been under drought conditions for drinking water, they're now running out of air and space, more people herded into smaller confines. Unlike the weather forecasters, no one's specific about our political or economic futures. All we know is trouble's coming, and not for those who caused it. If the next pandemic doesn't get us, a psychopathic, narcissistic president surely will. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 6th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Ray Bodwell. The co-producers are Josh Salem and Reed Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Mohn, Nadia Ramlagan, and Jill Freitas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact Radio. We'll be right back.
Making contact.
Okay, I'm walking up into Berth 20 at the Port of Oakland. Just walking up now. I can see a number of police cars as I'm walking up.
It's the morning of November 3rd, and the military supply ship Cape Orlando is moored here at the Port of Oakland. I'm surrounded by activists waving Palestinian flags and holding signs like Stop the Genocide.
Okay, so I am here standing in front of the ship Cape Orlando. The gate to the fence has currently been blocked by activists carrying a banner that says no U.S. military aid to Israel. There is a drum circle, as you can hear. I would estimate there to be at least a couple hundred people out here.
These activists came here to stop this ship from leaving.
We became aware that a military vessel was leaving the Port of Oakland this morning, intended to go to the State of Israel and carry military cargo.
That's Lara Kiswani, the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center.